my little formal thing, but I think I won't read us because you've all heard it before. We all know how, what a blessing it is to have Nancy and Rosemary in our midst a couple times a year now and be able to hear about the book that they're writing and dialogue.
Yes.
And I'm also hoping we can hear a teeny bit about the process of how it is for you two to be writing it.
Oh,
yes. Because I know something you said to me was kind of interesting.
Challenging.
Yes. What the process is.
Yeah.
But these are two of the most amazing people who have inspired us so deeply. So their work in social justice and everything they do, their work on relationship and mutuality and all the things they're going to be talking about today and building community.
And you do too.
Yeah. So, welcome.
Good. Good. Thank you. We have, we're going to do this back and forth, we think. But we had really thought a lot about preparing for today, this topic, because it's very, very important to us. And so we have some notes, and I said to Rosemary, now you take the notes and you decide what I'm going to say and what you're going to say, and so that's what we've done. So if we look a little awkward passing this thing back and forth, it will make it much more, and then we can get into discussion with all of you. Well, we started this by saying that Wellspring wrote its first formal mission statement in 1987. When we started in 1981, the founders had a vision statement. We knew what we wanted to do. But it wasn't until 7 years later, 6 years later, that we wrote with other people a mission statement. And in that mission statement, which we've brought a copy of, and I'll just read the first part of it. Now this would have been done at that time by 1987. It was not just the founders. It would have been, we had gotten a contract with the state of Massachusetts to help fund the shelter program. So we were able to hire some staff. So we had staff. Annie had come on in 1986. She was there working with volunteers and then became director of development. Nicole was already working with us, Nicole Scholl, and there were board members. We had a very active board at that time, a young board, and volunteers, as well as some of the founders, not all of the founders. And we were fortunate enough to get money from the Fund for the Homeless to pay for a strategic plan, to have consultants come in and work with us. And in that statement, we started with this whole group now said this about Wellspring. Wellspring is a community of faith, aware that each life touches every other life. Our work and our decisions are therefore guided by the vision of a just society in which we must care for the earth and her people by using our resources, property, and land in a spirit of hospitality. In this spirit, we work to meet basic human needs and participate in social change through the provision of shelter, affordable housing, local economic opportunity, and education rooted in community needs. Wow. But interesting for us was, as Rosemary and I have been working on the book and looking through massive amount of literature, it came to us about 1987 that while the founders had intentionally wanted to live community life and we had been very intentional about it, and we were committed to community for the sake of mission, for the sake of social justice, but particularly for the sake of sharing our home with people who needed a home for a while. So when this group of people came together and unanimously defined Wellspring in the first sentence as a community, as we talked about this a few months ago, it kind of said, wow, that was rather revolutionary. We did not define ourselves. We did not say Wellspring is a multi-service organization. We did not say we're a community-based organization. We said we were a community of faith. So I think that that's really important and has stood that definition, that mission statement was in place until about 2010. And we'll talk about why that phrase, community of faith, was problematic to some people who felt we were talking about a faith community and therefore a denominational community. And Annie and I were talking recently about the fact that when we were having the strategic planning process, we remember this great debate when we said Wellspring is a community of faith. And immediately there were some who said, rooted in the Jewish Christian tradition. And most people went, no, we're rooted in our care for each other, in our belief of each other. So that was quite important.
The faith that we can trudge to transformation.
That's right, yes. The faith in each other.
That
That's
was
right.
Annie's phrase that summed up what we were feeling like at the time. There's a good deal of trudging involved. And we didn't set out, as Nancy said, we didn't set out to offer any particular service, but we did have this sense of that hospitality was at the heart of what we were doing, right?
Yes.
In 1989, the board decided to buy the house at 99 Washington Street.
1984, right?
1984, beg your pardon. Yes. And so this was an instance of the fact that we didn't have a plan beforehand. I forget exactly how that came our way. Somebody offered it to us, didn't they?
No. Well, yes. Actually, the person who owned it offered it to us because he rang and he said, I think I have a house that you girls might like to use. So Mary Jane and I went down and looked at it, and well, that's another whole story. But yeah. that was Washington Street.
Yeah, we said no way we would buy it, rent it. He wanted to rent it to us. It was practically falling down. But anyway, that was done up and done, became a home for homeless men and women.
No, honey, you're talking about Chestnut Street now. You're mixing up the notes.
So I'm not mixing them up, right?
My fault.
Well, it happened at just that time that we had a lot of families in the shelter who were always on the verge of finding somewhere to go because they had their certificates, didn't they? Right?
Yes.
And Dukakis at that time made a lot of help available for homeless families. And so when they'd been in the shelter a while, they could get a 707 certificate, which would entitle them to lower rents. And so it really didn't take very long to find something, but probably too long to allow us to take more people into the shelter. So wanted to get somehow moved on a bit. And this house in Washington Street became that house.
Right.
Little two-room units.
Mm-hmm.
A unit for somebody to look after it. And the board said that housing was not the solution to homelessness.
Shelter was not the solution. That
shelter was not the solution to homelessness. And many people had assumed that since we had become something was called a shelter, that was what we were doing. But we knew right from the beginning that that was not the answer. So when they began to be able to look at the possible date for moving, they needed to be in somewhere in the meantime, and that was that Washington Street house with it. But then the board entered into a... Sorry about this. My voice is not doing me well. And they formed a contract with the Commonwealth, with Massachusetts, to provide shelter for homeless families. And we'd been doing it, but it wasn't formal. And when we had, at the very beginning, we had a number of different kinds of people. And after a certain time, we became to realize that some of them didn't mix very well, and we were good at caring for families, so that was what we were doing. And when the Dukakis regime began to make it easier to care for homeless people, we found it a great help. And we got a contract with the Commonwealth to provide shelter. And that meant we had a regular income coming in. So for the first time, we were able to pay staff and also ourselves, because until that time, all of us had had work of some kind outside to support the work that we were doing at 302 Essex Avenue. And that made a big difference. And it was, so we had some staff, and we were able to be part-time staff ourselves. And then in 86, wasn't it, yeah, that you came, and Bonnie Stafford, and they were co-directors of the growing volunteer part of this, because more families we had, the more help we needed. And it was quite exciting. There was so much going on. There was such a liveliness in there. And we remember a man who came. We were raising money and we didn't have quite enough. What was that bit?
Well, that was basically when we did the capital campaign. That was later.
Yeah, it was later. But it's an example of what the impression that the place made. He was a man who was helping, but he hadn't really seen what was going on, and he wasn't too sure he wanted to support it. And when he came into the house, and there were children running around with rather jammy faces, and he began to realize the sort of humanness of the thing and what was really going on. Anyway, he came up with a lot of money, which was very nice. But as Nancy said, I'm being a bit previous.
It's okay.
So there was the Chestnut Street house, not long. That was in 87, so quite soon afterwards. We managed to buy a house in Chestnut Street that was one of the very few lodging houses at that time. There had been a lot, but many of them had been turned into condos and were not available anymore. And there were 10 rooms in that house. And most of them were, eight were occupied, weren't they, at mm-hmm. that time? And it was the conditions were quite appalling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd never seen anything how awful, not just cockroaches and dirt, but extreme, horrible. The horrible dirtiness and sickness. And anyway, we sort of jumped at that, but... Nancy was taking care of the men who, because we were obviously had to get them out of the house while it was going on, the building was going on, and we moved them into rooms at the Crow's Nest. And Nancy went down every week to pay the rent for them. And they were to stay there while it was all going on. And it was, I forget exactly, it did only a few months, actually. Yes. It was amazingly quick. And when it was really rather sad and touching when the place was ready, and we had worked so hard to paint it and make it look nice, and we couldn't afford very new furniture, but we painted old bureaus and things, and it looked very nice. And one of the men, Nancy met him when she came, and he had his duffel bag on his shoulder, and she said to him, "Where are you going?" And he said, "Well, you say it, Nancy."
He said, "I'll be leaving now. You won't want the likes of me in this beautiful place."
Oh,
wow.
And I said, "Ernie, we did this place for you." So I said, "Come on, walk back in with me." But I was so glad I got there at that time. Really,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
But then that house, we had 5 men and 5 women. Previously, it had been all men, and the first floor was women, the second floor was men, and there were separate bathrooms on each floor, and a common kitchen downstairs. It certainly wasn't luxurious, but it was a decent sort of place.
Right.
And there are people who, if they hadn't had that, would have been on the streets. You know, and many of them stayed there a very long time. And
so this was... Rosemary's going through the sequence from really 81 to 87 to say that when we gathered for the strategic plan in 1987, we had already done a lot. I mean, as we looked at it, we couldn't really believe that starting out very small, so many people came and said, I want to help, I want to do this, I want to do, but also we were presented with opportunities because mm-hmm. we just had these needs. We had the need for some transition housing, and we really, the state was after us to take a state contract. The state only started to fund shelters in 83, and the board finally agreed in 86, but said only ever 60% of what it costs, because we don't want to ever be with no money if the state pulls it, and then Chestnut mm-hmm. Street. So we brought that to this experience, and I think what we want to say about that is that the experience of doing the strategic plan included a process that we have used, that we used at Wellspring, which was based on Paulo Freire's conscientization. You basically conscientizations. You
okay.
become, and basically what Freire said is, you start always with experience. You start reflecting on the experience that you've lived, and then you evaluate it, you look at it, and then you see out of that what's next. And you begin dreaming and planning. So that was the whole process of the strategic plan, which is why, as Rosemary said, you can imagine when we met, we were going over all this. So what was that then calling us to in terms of the future? And the amazing thing that was really wonderful is what we recognized was so much had happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we lived as friends. We lived in relationship. And when you live in relationship, then there's an energy that is produced.
Mm-hmm.
And you're able, we found, you know, when we look back, we said, my goodness, we were able to accomplish things, not because we were great, we were able to accomplish things because we began to be in relationship with people all over the community. And when we needed a resource, we were able to find a resource. And we even had people like people who owned buildings who thought they could help. The one who owned Washington Street. And when we said, Mary Jane Veronese said, what do you think why would we ever rent this place? And she looked at me, because I'm nothing, there's no electricity, it was just, she looked at me and she said, I think we should buy it. And I said, well, how about if we buy it from you? Because I don't think, anyway, he finally said, why would I want to do that? And I said, so anyway, he said, I have to ask my wife. And then he held the mortgage. But when we had the groundbreaking, when we opened that building, he and his wife were there
mm-hmm.
at the party. And we thanked him for making it available. Now, that's not great for us, but that's just the kind of stuff that happened. And that's really what we want to talk about today, is that we defined Wellspring as a relational organization. And that's quite unique. The assets of a relational organization are each other, the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily the bottom line, though one has to have very much financial responsibility. But you hear what I'm saying? It's just a whole different way of knowing and believing what's important. And now this model, of course, is being talked about a great deal. But you still have this idea that to be a good organization, in some ways, and as somebody said to us in about 28, this is a business. Wellspring is a business. I can remember hearing that, and I thought, well, we've always had to be a business, but I wouldn't define ourselves as a business. So that's just to give you a kind of sense of, if you're a business, you're going to protect the assets of the corporation, which are money. If you're a relational organization, you realize that the greatest assets are each other. And that doesn't mean that you don't, as I said, have to have financial responsibility. But that's kind of where to go through this. And just to remember, it was quite startling to us when we just saw it in that short period of time. The basic foundation of Wellspring had basically been set. Okay, honey.
Yes. And I remember that I hadn't read Paulo de Freire's book as Nancy had. And it wasn't until later that I read it and discovered that was actually what we were doing, you know. I mean, it was such a, it seemed such an obvious thing to be doing, doing something together as friends, and then having a look at what we've done, the good things and the mistakes we might have made, and saying, what can we learn from this? And we plan out of that experience, and at the same time, we're immediately having different experience. So it's a cycle that goes on and on. And it was, I think it's difficult sometimes for people to recognize that we were never a multi-service organization or a service of any particular kind. The work came out of the work as a community came out of that sense of hospitality. And the community by then, at the time we were doing the mission statement, the community already was not just the founders. In fact, some of the people who were the founders had moved on. Two got married, you know. And so other people were part of the community, not in the sense necessarily of living in the house, but of being part of the work. That was the important thing. We did have a few people who thought they would like to be part of a live-in community, but we discovered that some of them really, that all they wanted to do was to be there and be looked after. You know, it's just psychologically cozy, you know, and it really didn't work. As you can imagine, it created some difficulties. But the thing that worked was the common commitment to social justice, to a vision of what could be. And people were attracted by that. They didn't necessarily have the particular skills that were needed for one thing or another, but there were people who said came to us and said, what can I do? What can I bring? And that included sometimes the people who came to us for help when they'd been there for a while. They found, moving on, they found things they could do. They became part of the ongoing community. And the community extended way beyond the visible gathering of people whom you could name, because we became part of the Gloucester community. More and more people, as time went on, recognized Wellspring as an important aspect of Gloucester's life, and would ask us to join in discussions or reflect on problems together. It was really, it happened fairly quickly, didn't it?
Well, it happened, I mean, when we were thinking about and decided we would come to Gloucester, John McCullough, who was our attorney, wrote a letter to the building inspector, and he basically said that, he said, this group is coming, and they're going to, they have bought 302 Essex Avenue, and we want you to know that they will be paying property taxes, because as part of the community, they know they're going to need services, but they want to be partners. And interestingly, when we were putting the addition onto 302 Essex Avenue, well, not an addition, but converting what had been the art studio into bedrooms, the building inspector came by, and he didn't remember getting that letter, but it saved the day for us, because we didn't have a building permit, because the contractor hadn't gotten a building permit. But when John said to him, but I wrote you this letter here, I have a copy of it, then he said, oh, and he said, you got to be kidding me, this group isn't going to be paying property taxes. And John said, it's here, it's their commitment. And we kept that commitment. And I think that that was, I think that for us, again, that's quite unique as a nonprofit. But we did, and that is no longer, but for those years we did, and not on just that one property, but on any property we had, because, again, that real estate takes services, and we always wanted to be here as partners. Rosemary, I was thinking when you were talking also about, you know, the fact of just being a community, just being in a place, and living as a community with friends is basically a structure or something of social justice. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, and that's what always surprised me. We didn't have to do much else except be there and take care of that property, and people knew that different kinds of people were living in the house, and they would see baby carriages, and they would see this, and they'd see that, and that in itself, I think, I don't know, it's one thing, as Rosemary and I now, we're getting to the point of the book where we want to begin looking at impact. I mean, really, what can people tell us was the impact of Wellspring that we'll be able then to put people's stories in? But I think that that presence, was at a time in 81, people were pretty, I think, really looking for something. The individualism of the 60s was kind of waning. People were kind of, but I think that in itself is just just for people became, and for us, it was acting out the vision is what it was doing. Mm-hmm. And hospitality means having all kinds, radical hospitality, having all kinds of people in your home. The people that most of the people in society wouldn't take. So that's again, this communitarian relational model.
I think it's important to emphasize that because even recently we've heard people talk about a community is a messy idea. Uh-huh. And I can understand where that comes from, because usually you don't have necessarily any particular titles at the early stages anyway. And so you can easily admit sort of it's just where people, they like to get together so they do things. So, you know, it's just a messy sort of thing, and it doesn't have a niche, was the word we heard recently. And a community should have a niche, a little, do this particular thing, and that's its niche. Well, we never had a niche and never wanted to. What we were doing was to respond as best as we could to certain needs that presented themselves or opportunities that presented themselves. And not obviously at random or any one of those, but something that we felt at that stage in our development that, yes, we think we could make success of that and begin to put it together. And that pulled in all kinds of people. So there's a...
I was just going to say about the messiness. I don't know. I still hear that a lot. People believe that if you have a communitarian model, then it's bound to be messy because it doesn't have roles. It's too loose. And my experience is that I'll tell you, living community intentionally is bloody hard work. It really is hard work. It's probably harder than if you live in a hierarchical model, because in a hierarchical model, you know exactly, you have a definition of this role, a definition of the other. Well, as we developed, we also had job descriptions, and it was very definite, but you had to be intentional, and you have to be intentional about living relationally. There are certain things that at one point we had bottom lines for shelter staff, so that shelter staff could see that there was just certain things that were calling us always to live in relationship and not to live.
Can you say what some of those are?
Well, some of those were things like you never second guess a decision that another colleague makes, and you believe that everyone on the staff wants to do their best, and we give direct feedback to each other, and be willing to, if you made a decision with a shelter guest, and maybe it was not the wisest decision, you would still get support for that. You would have to, but basic things like it wasn't power over, it was power with. It was to help everyone feel that they had power within the group, so.
And it doesn't mean we didn't make mistakes. We made some small and some quite major mistakes, but we could support each other to work through that, to see what went wrong and how we can put it right and the things we shouldn't do next time. So that was all part of learning to be a community. And it obviously attracted people very much, as you know. Where do we get to, Nancy? I'm trying to think. What I was just going to say something, and I can't remember.
Well, we did make mistakes.
Yes,
but mistakes are not. I mean, That's part of life, and it's what you do with mistakes. You don't excuse yourself. You accept the responsibility for doing it. Yes, we did, and you learn from them if that's possible. I just wanted to. I don't know. What we're finding as we're writing about this, there's so much being written right now about relational organizations. Rosemary and I have been part of a group of people from Boston and other places working on, we call it the Blue Moon Group, because it's like once in a blue moon you come across something very special. And this is a group that's working on mutuality, looking at everything from brain science to how our brains are made for connection, looking at the qualities of mutuality, the practices of mutuality, and it's been so we're really delving into this and mm-hmm. looking at things like relational leadership, and what does that mean? How is a leader in a relational model? And the really mm-hmm. I think key thing is that when you are in a relational leadership, you have power with, you do not have power over. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something as a society we're dealing with. But I've also been reading this book. Have any of you read David Brooks' book yet? Well, this is interesting. This is The Second Mountain. It's just come out. Been out maybe a month or two. And this is a book about his own journey, moving from individualism to an awareness of relationship and community. And I think it's very, very good. I've been reading along with it, but he basically says that the individualism of the 60s has just gotten extended and extended, and most of us, many people who are working with other people and or themselves, they have the first mountain is how you make it. You get your education, you get your job, you make your money, and you're achieving, and it's all very individualistic. And it can be that way also as we work with people. We work with people to help individuals get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? And in terms of that whole sense of how can we work with individuals how can we work with people in a way that their personal goals are met, but where they are connecting with other people, where they're also getting an experience. And one thing I was saying to Rosemary just as early this morning, I remember that when we had the foundations class, Amy, you'll remember this too, every morning began with a connection, a check-in. We sat around in a circle, all the students, with the teachers who were there, and that's how the morning began, with the group connecting, a check-in. It might be just checking in what's happened since you left class yesterday, or it might be that Susan Hershey would throw out a poem, would read a poem, or she would ask a question, and that was the bonding of groups of women who just did not get what they wanted out of foundations individually. They didn't just get their computer skills, Catherine, or they didn't get this, or they didn't get that. They made friendships, not only with each other, but it was the way that entire staff worked. I remember Jane Sonstall and Syl Treves, and how their friendship, their personal friendship, radiated toward the women, and the women could see that, admire that, and emulate it, really. So that's the check-in. Plus, at every level of the organization, when Annie was director of development, she always had team meetings.
Mm-hmm.
We had an administrative team with me and with Annie and with the treasurer and with Rosemary, but then every program had a team meeting, and the expectation was that people had meetings together. And goodness knows, the education, the foundation meetings were really intense. But that idea of people working together in teams. And I would meet with the program directors once every 3 weeks so that they could talk together and they could talk about their goals, their hopes and stuff. It's so important. It's very, very time consuming, but I wouldn't exchange it for anything in the world in terms of, again, the energy it produces. The fact that people are connected with each other. So that's incredibly important. And I think that he's hit this. His life fell apart in about 2013 when his marriage ended. And he had to realize that he had spent his whole adult career up to that point achieving and getting very famous and being very smart and doing all this. And then finding that his wife was already on the second mountain. And she had really, so the book is, I think it's very, very very good. Annie, have you read it? You getting
I
into
have
it?
It, and I've started it.
Okay. So that's the, I think there's a lot being, mutuality and working together and community, goodness knows, and connection is very important. And beyond that, there are three, I think, for our experience, and you can say, though most of you know Wellspring, would say whether you agree. I think three C's. There's commitment to the mission. If you don't have commitment and you don't have a mission, I mean, this is something that is, we're called to do something together. And for Wellspring, it was very large in terms of social justice. And how we chose to do that was by working with homeless families. But then realizing they needed shelter, they needed jobs, they needed this. So that was so commitment to the mission, and that they, any one thing you take on, like with homelessness, it is complex. So just to go after, as Rosemary said, that niche. Doesn't quite, you can't stay contained with that. The second is convening, and I've just already referred to that. You need to convene. Mm-hmm. Students need to convene. People living in the houses need to convene. Staff need to convene. Boards need to convene. Volunteers need to convene. And we had larger convenings, which were in 91, 96, 2001, 2006, and they were all about getting the larger community of Cape Ann together to really reflect on what Wellspring was doing, have Wellspring put it out, and then have people come back to us in dialogue with what they saw next.
Yeah, it was at the beginning, those were about what Wellspring should be doing next, and then they involved the whole community to come to us and say, just ask them, what do you want Wellspring to contribute to the local community?
And the last is celebration. And anybody who knows Wellspring knows the celebrations. One of the first, I mean, we just celebrated. And we had music. And Song of the Soul was our song. And what do you do for a living? Are you forgiving? Are you giving shelter? We sang. We sang lots. And the students sang. And people sometimes got embarrassed when we were at board meetings and we didn't get the board to get up and sing. They weren't quite used to singing, but they caught it. And the first spring became very important for us to celebrate Passover. We felt that it was such a symbolic ritual of people who were homeless in a foreign land finding their way home. And it was very powerful. It was a very powerful celebration.
We created a more modest version, and there are many.
Right.
And everybody around the table took it in turns to read one particular bit, and there were the songs and the breaking of the bread.
Right.
And it was just incredible. I mean, people who sort of thought, well, this is a bit odd. You know, when they actually saw it happening, they knew it was right.
Next year, Jerusalem, and for the families, it would be next year my own home.
Yes.
You know, and then the second one, which, and there were many. I mean, I won't say nothing about the fundraisers and the parties and all that. But the next celebration was the winter solstice itself, being so, so symbolic of people, women gathering, and remembering the darkness, and there were 40, 50 women, and we would come together and sit, and they remember the darkness of the previous year, and then we'd bring the light back in, and we would call in the light, mm-hmm. and then we would go out back, and we would have a fire, and we would howl at the moon, and just really celebrate the fact that light is greater than darkness. But beyond that, and Annie was so responsible for so much of this, parties and people who gave their home. I think of, you know, Joanne Hart and Gordon Beard the first year, who gave their place so that we could celebrate our 10th anniversary, and Mac and Annie Bell, who a couple times had big parties over at their place, and Bob Rogers, who came on the board, who then did Broadway Under the Stars at the Bells, which was an unbelievable Broadway show. And then we had on the waterfront down at, tell me where that was, Annie.
It's AmeriCold.
Yeah.
Right. And
or AmeriCold.
AmeriCold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I still remember the...
And Henry did the film.
And Henry, you did the film mm-hmm. for that. Yes, and we did have...
We made the man at the wheel talk.
Yeah, that was great.
You did make the man at the wheel talk. And we had the fireboat.
Yes,
you remember that? It came by with its lights. I mean, the whole thing was just, we've just had some wonderful, I would say a community committed to the mission of social justice, committed to each other's, you know, welfare, and from all kinds, you just absolutely have to celebrate. I mean, we mm-hmm. celebrated every family that got their home. We celebrated every birthday. We celebrated
every birth,
and we shared life. I mean, we had, you know, it was sharing birth, and it was sharing death. I mean, Annie, you were at Amanda's birth, right?
Yes,
when
I
Amanda
was.
Gave birth.
Yeah.
I mean, unusual that Nicole Scholl, God knows how many births she attended. I attended many. I mean, women would go into labor, and they'd say, "Come with me," you know, and you did it, and. We had a woman who was dying at Addison Gilbert of cancer.
She'd been in the shelter before.
She'd been in the shelter, had gotten her housing, and she developed stage 4 cancer and did what they could, and she was in Addison Gilbert. And the doctors told her that they could do nothing else, and they were going to move her over to the nursing home, which is, what's it?
Seacoast.
And... Kathy McIntyre, who had been president of Wellsprings Board the first time, was the social worker there. And Kathy said to her, "What do you want?" And Linda said, "I want to go home to die. I want to go to Wellspring." Mm-hmm. And Kathy called me and she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I'll talk to Mary Jane and Rosemary and we'll see." And without a doubt, we brought in a hospital bed, and... her little boy at that point was in foster care because she hadn't been able to care for him. And the one thing she wanted to do was to be well enough, strong enough, that she could sign the paper telling the children, friend, whatever, to put him up, to authorize his adoption, because there was a family ready to adopt him. Mm. And she came on the Saturday before Easter, I guess Friday before Easter, and she was there, and her little boy was able to come. The foster parents agreed he could come and stay with her. And he was, all the other kids in the shelter were having an Easter egg hunt. And he was back and forth. He would run out and play with the kids, and then he'd come back in and get up on the bed with her and tell her he loved her, and she'd say, "I love you." And he left, he said goodbye that night, and she died that night with us around her. Now, I'm not saying that was great of us to do. It's what we do for each other. I mean, it is what we do for each other. And when Kathy McIntyre got hospice all into place for us, so we had hospice nurses there, you know, making sure she had the injections. We also had music playing, and we had flowers for her, and she knew she was home. So I guess that's... pretty much what Rosemary and I think are discovering is how precious it has been for us to live this life. It really has. I can't. Where, I mean, a choice of seven people to buy a house and live community and share a home with each other. And it was just like, well, some people have said it. It was just like something got lit. St. Gloucester was the place to come. People were ready. People realized what we were doing. And so that's, if Fanny says, what's it been like? I mean, sometimes we just, we sit, we talk, we write, we research, we cry, we laugh. And so I don't know what that, why don't you read the last bit from Anne Louise and Catherine?
Yes,
and
we pulled this out because Catherine and Anne Louise were our wonderful Irish friends who meant such a lot to Wellspring. And this is what they wrote sometime afterwards. So it comes from part in their story when they'd got to know people in Boston who were working with homeless women at Rosie's place. Mm-hmm. And we were unaware that during the summer, prior to our own arrival in Boston, a small group of people had purchased a 17th century house in West Gloucester. Excuse me. They were to have considerable influence on how we shaped our own dream. Their dreams turned out quite amazing. They were one afternoon in the spring of 1982, we noticed a poster in Boston College that Rosemary Horton, the author and theologian, was giving a talk on her latest book. So we attended the lecture and were impressed. So towards the end of her talk, she mentioned Wellspring, a house that she and others had purchased to become their home and a place to pursue a common commitment to social justice by offering hospitality to those who needed it. So next weekend, after we'd finished breakfast at Charlie's, a restaurant beloved of the locals, we decided to see if we could find Wellspring. Three policemen were eating at a table near us, and we asked them if they'd heard of the house and if they knew where it was. "Just your luck," said one of them, because he had run an article about the house in the Gloucester Times the week before. He gave us directions. We jumped into our car with considerable enthusiasm for the adventure. About 15 minutes later, we pulled up in the driveway of this former stagecoach inn. Our knock on the door was answered by Nancy Schwoyer, and she invited us in to share a pot of tea she'd just made for herself and Rosemary. They told us about how Paul, an assistant superintendent of schools, and Mary Jane, a school teacher, had sold their family home to use it for the down payment on the property. They talked about other members of the group, all people who were prepared to leave their previous employment and their homes in order to develop together what would soon become one of the first family shelters in the state. Since then, Wellspring has become a national leader in the field of family shelter programs, education programs for people on low income, and the development of affordable housing. Their public policy work has been influential in lawmaking and public expenditure to end homelessness. The vision of its earliest years contained the possibility of all this. What impressed us most, however, was how the friendship shared between Rosemary and Nancy and other members of the community provided a relational power effective enough to develop new social and economic systems for the towns and cities of Massachusetts. Subsequently, we often sat at their table having meals with their guests who had been homeless. We gathered by their fireside to reflect with the guests and members of the community and public policy experts on lessons learned from their work within a setting of mutual respect, care, and shared resources. We witnessed conflict, its resolution, its hardship. We felt the potency of faithful hope. She says that this was written some years later, mm-hmm. and it had the benefit of hindsight, but it gives us a sense of what Wellspring looked and felt like to someone from outside. And that is, I think you know, that it had that sort of effect on a lot of people. And it was such a, in many ways, a very odd experience. In other ways, it just seemed normal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That we were there, we were friends, we knew we wanted to do something about towards social justice, even if it was a tiny bit, and we didn't expect more than a little bit. But it grew, because other people caught it. That was how it developed.
And it lives on in the work Annie and Henry are doing here in the Writers' Center, and so much of what Jeffrey has done in this community. It just lives on. People are just, it's amazing. Stacy Randall at North Shore Community College, Nancy Goodman working at the high school and doing so much. You see, and that's not just all Wellspring. I mean, that's just the fact that having had that experience, people continue to live it out. And that for us, no longer at Wellspring, that really gives us great hope. I think it's a sign that this whole relational model, and based on hospitality, the spirit of hospitality is.
And I think it's at this point in history, it just seems incredibly important that people feel that they can. They might not be experts of anything, but people can get together to work at something they feel matters, like those school kids all over the world who are going on strike. But they're not experts in anything except they know there's something important, and they want to confront it. And that sort of thing is happening. It's the same kind of thing that we experienced. So, and it's so important right now that it should continue. That should all these little shoots. You know how
I'm thinking of that Margaret Mead quote so much. Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing they ever has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
And I've just finished reading a book called The Overstory, but it's about trees and a lot of odd people. But what it makes clear, and which we had heard before, is that when there's a tree, underground, thousands of little tendrils, whatever it's called, and they pop up in an increasing ring that goes long. It's much more than I had understood. I knew it happened, but till I read this book. And I think that's what's happened with so many good things, like what happened with us.
Mm-hmm.
And there is hope in this extremely dangerous and sad world, that those little shoots will pop up in unexpected places and they'll grow.
So, a little rough starting here, but here we are. How about conversation? Comments on what we said? Yes.
For both of you. I'm curious about the personalities you had before you started this, because most of us can't even live with a roommate. So this whole idea about hospitality must come from a certain mindset. Like, were you good cooks before?
Rosemary was a good cook. I was a good cook. Mary Jane hated to cook. Paul was not a cook. No, I know what you're saying.
But it's very difficult to live with other people and share a kitchen, and who left these dirty dishes here. How did you cope? And kids running around who have no manners, and the noise. I'd like to hear some of the nitty-gritty detail about the problems and how you manage them.
Well, I think the seven of us really wanted to do it. I mean, and we talked about it a long time. I mean, this was months. We talked about, could we do it and what would it take? So when we went into Wellspring, we had certain things that you know, we knew we were going to have to, we would have to share the expenses. And so we did a budget of, once we had the house, I mean, we knew what that was going to cost, that we'd each have to work so we could put in $500 a month. We also knew that there would be personal things that we would have to take responsibility for. Our car insurance, our health insurance, those were not things that were communal. We also made the decision early on that we would not, if any of us left Wellspring, we would not claim anything. So we would not expect to be paid for what we had done. We would not take anything except maybe personal things that we had brought. But even Paul and Mary Jane brought all their furniture and never took any of it. But those things were very important. And we knew, we had all had experience of people living, of sharing our home with other people. Maybe only one or two at a time, but Rosemary had lived in a community in Scotland. But and Mary Jane and Paul had taken students, young high school students who needed a place, that maybe one or two at a time. So that was, and I don't know why, it didn't.
Well,
isn't that fun of it? That
we
part
also
of it,
had rules,
huh?
Right?
Well,
we did.
We had boundaries. We did have boundaries.
I can remember occasions when I got really exasperated with someone. You know, I mean, if you're choosing a roommate, you may do it because that's convenient. You share the rent and so on. But if you're there for a purpose that everybody's embracing, it doesn't make it easy, but it makes it possible.
Yeah, I think one thing, I remember one thing when things got very tense with the seven of us, because nobody was coming to us. We didn't have, I mean, we went there in August and nobody came till December. It was like, but I do remember just about that happened. Then two people came in December and that was kind of it. What I remember is being really, really exasperated with one person. But when somebody was coming, and in those early years, we'd have to take people in an emergency. I mean, if people had nowhere to go, they would come and maybe sleep in the chapel, or they'd sleep on the couch in the living room. But I do remember always when we had to make up the bed for somebody. Making a bed with someone else across was always that thing, this is what we're here for. And it kind of grounded me to say, stop it, just stop the nonsense. But we did, as we had more people, we had to have rules. We had people shared. Anybody who came shared with the housework, they shared with dishes, you know, they shared in things. And Mary Jane also had a sign at the kitchen that said, wash, wipe, and put away. And Mary Jane would not stand anybody leaving dishes, and if she did, she could always track them down. But then as we had more people that came, we obviously had to have more guidelines about when people were in the kitchen, when they weren't in the kitchen, and that kind of stuff.
Not smoking and that kind of thing.
That's right.
Mm.
And where they could smoke.
At what point, not smoking ash. That happened too.
So, does that help?
That's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And of course the fire department helped us a great deal too, because the fire department would come, and if they saw baby carriages where they shouldn't be, they were the ones who addressed it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, they would say to it, you know, this is blocking an exit to this house. Whose is this? And I think it was always important to say it belongs to me. Well, could you get Mary? They were always very nice. Could you get Mary to come down? And then they'd say, you know, please, you can't do this, because if you have to leave this house quickly, you're not going to be able to get out, but it's going to block other people. So they were very helpful. And also, when we had the inspections from the health people and stuff, they would point things out that, again, was coming from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't coming from us. So they began to realize, you know what, this isn't just Wellspring with rules. This is how you have to live if you're going to want to get a place.
Mm-hmm.
So that was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Well, I always remember you would talk about, and I always loved this model, about coming from a place of looking at people's capacity, not their deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's part of this whole mutuality and relationship that you work on assets and not deficiencies.
And it's so countercultural.
Oh.
I mean, we're also obsessed with our own deficiencies.
Yes.
You know, it's like how to get, it's really interesting. Yeah.
And it's very interesting. It's difficult when you get into the fundraising stuff not to rely on the sub stories, you know, the deficiencies,
that's right.
In other words.
Yeah.
And because it's a trap, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I remember one woman, she's dead now, Lisa. But I remember asking her one time if she would be willing to speak at an event that Wellspring was having. And she just looked at me and she said, no. And I said, no. She said, no. I am tired of being your poster girl.
Mm.
And I said, talked to me about this. She said, do you know what it's like to stand up in front of people and have to kind of make a case for what I went through and now how good I am because of Wellspring?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have to be so careful with that. That happened. That, mm-hmm. That happens. And I changed it totally. I said, Lisa, you are, I'm, so people in the future would say to me, well, what about Lisa? And I said, no, you can ask her if you want to, but you know, if she can speak about something else, but not about her own story. People love, so we talked about, another part of that is individualism. You know, I can remember the first time that somebody used the thing, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And Rosemary looked at the person, I think it was somebody from the welfare department or somebody. And Rosemary looked and she said, excuse me, but have you ever tried to pull yourself up by your bootstraps? And the person would have said no. She said, you'd fall flat on your face. Do you remember that?
Yes.
You have to, but we do, we expect an awful lot of people, don't we?
Did you have private practices that would help you keep your perspective of looking for the capacity, for example, instead of mm-hmm. deficiency?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the regular gathering for little circles like the administrative team, that was a chance to bring up things that might be difficult and talk about them, mm-hmm. because that was what it was for. Uh-huh. I think
the shelter staff always they used to meet every week at the beginning of the week for reflection and time, and I think they grew, they got a lot of strength out of that, and always reminded each other of it's very difficult thing goes into it, but you really have to. And we also had you know, times of meditation and reflection, and we'd have speakers who would come in just to remind us of it's really.
And we so had, you just as you had to do group work, you had to do yourself work as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And we used to have a very informal kind of worship gathering, ecumenical. We chose our own readings. At one point early on, we had Mark Baker who could sing, and it was wonderful to have live music. But if we didn't have live music, we'd use tapes, and it was very helpful. And part of it was to talk about, to read and then to talk, you know, sharing things that just happened, difficult things or hopeful things, you know. Wasn't it?
Yes, yes. I think it was the people around. I mean, Annie is sitting right over there, but an incredible gift to Wellspring, really, because she comes out of that, of a real deep belief in relationships and also in assets. I think you do, and she really was, and she knew so many people. I mean, Henry was always getting a call from Annie saying, Henry, we're having this little do. How about, could we have a little film? Henry could, but a great, she made people feel included, didn't she?
She still does.
She's wonderful.
Well, the thing that I found that I responded to early on, because I had a 2.5-year-old home and I wanted to start getting out of the house and volunteering, and what you were doing was such a cultural antidote, mm-hmm. because it was relational. It was people coming from a deep place mm-hmm. to make something happen and asking other people to join in. Mm-hmm. So it was really, and also I'd always had this feeling here in Gloucester and Cape Ann, it's like, if we can't do it here, where can we do it? Because we have such a good scale.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It was really so meaningful to
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and everybody. I mean, Throttle used to come and do the child care.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember coming to this place before it even was really ready to go, and that was our family decided, Christmas is coming, and this year we will not give each other presents, uh-huh. and we are going to give each other money, not each other, but we make a big uh-huh. of money, where are we going to put it?
Uh-huh.
So that's where it went in the beginning.
Well,
and that started.
Yes.
And then we had, when you had a meeting with the people here, we sometimes had the children. So they brought their children,
yeah.
And then we had the children in
yes.
the special room.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
That's yeah. what for me started. And then in the summertime, we had summer programs for the children
yes.
mm-hmm. and their mothers
yes.
together.
So yes, mm-hmm. yes.
So that
yes.
was a, mm-hmm. was a very
yes.
wonderful
yes.
time for,
yes.
for all of us. And,
mm-hmm.
And the, my whole family was involved in there, you know, Hans
yeah.
And not Lynn, but Susan and,
yes.
and the children. They all had
yes.
a part in this.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes, yes.
Yeah. Cleaning the gardens,
mm-hmm.
doing. And that was for them, for especially for the children, really good because
mm.
they turned out to be... by giving children
yes,
this,
yes.
jobs now. With, hospital jobs and garden jobs.
It's wonderful.
That gives me an excuse to mention the gardens, because we haven't had time, but yes, the gardens were so important to everybody who came. The fact that this was a... You know, people expect people who work for the poor to do it in a sort of... a dull sort of corner, you know. But the fact that the place was surrounded with flowers made such a difference to how people felt
mm.
about themselves and how people felt coming to the house, didn't it?
Mm.
And it's the earth and her people.
Yeah,
right,
the earth.
Right, right.
And just
right.
that whole, the relief of a message of we don't have to be in our separate corners.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, there can be shared commitment.
Oh, oh.
It's just
mm-hmm.
so
mm.
great.
So we've been very lucky having that experience.
Mm. Very, very blessed.
And when the book comes out, we're going to have a huge celebration.
Of course.
We have a big party?
Yes, absolutely.
Jeffrey came to a party when Rosemary and I were staying over at the Beauport before we went back at Christmas time. We were there for a couple nights, and so there were a group of people who got together just to think about the solstice. And Jeffrey came. Well, it was a good party, wasn't it, Jeffrey?
Yes,
you know, he was sat and talked and had some wine and just, you know, it was just, it's the connections are amazing. They're such a gift. I mean, we know so many people, and so it's just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. You can always, you know, it's great. It's a gift. It's relationships.
Talk a little bit about how you're actually doing the writing. Are you doing it on paper or a computer? And how are you sharing the responsibility?
Well, Annie said, we talk about this. This is tell you, well, Rosemary, you said it's about writing together. What did you say? It's really...
much harder than writing on one's own.
Mm.
I've done a lot of that. And I realize now that I had it easy.
And you've done that in longhand, right?
I still do that because
yeah.
it helps me to get something down. And then when I transfer it, you know, to the computer, I can correct as I go. And that really is helpful for me.
So does one of you edit the other?
So
or?
Basically what has happened
both
is
ways.
We talk. We have 2 days a week where we try to give at least 3 hours a day to writing, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And we've been very faithful to that while we're in England. We have been less faithful to that since we've been here. But we've done other things to get the book in terms of meeting with people and stuff like that. But so we usually on Tuesday we usually talk about where are we, look at where we are, and what's we pretty much know what's next, but we refine that a little bit, and we may be doing a little bit of writing at that point. But then what happens is that usually what happens is that Rosemary sees another bit that she really wants to get her teeth into, and so she will take on with that. She writes it longhand, then she puts it in the computer, at which point then I get it and I do editing. Sometimes it's when she's writing something and I'll put in things. So that's the way we've done it, and it's slow, but I think it's working. And now the last bit will be, I think, well, we'll cover, you know, we'll talk about basically the 90s, which were just explosive, but very briefly. We don't want this to be a chronological of what we've done. But the last bit was what I referred to. We really do want to hear from people who have been at Wellspring for education or for housing or for shelter, what the impact has been. How has Wellspring not only impacted their personal life, but has it been? Do they see it in their work? Do they, you know, those mm-hmm. kinds? So that's where we want to really work, and that'll be personal stories.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and two chapters actually, one each, because for Nancy and me to talk about how we got to that point. So those are comparatively easy. I started mine, but I haven't finished it. But I will. And then when we've done everything else, we'll write the introduction.
We wrote one introduction, but we think, no. Okay. So we're hoping that we really are really hoping that a year from now we'll have a first draft. You know, but I keep your fingers crossed.
So you'll come back in the fall and report on it.
Yes, how far we are. Mm-hmm. Do you have suggestions for us? Anything?
Every day. Write every day. Start writing over there in West Gloucester.
I know.
Well, the whole process is the writing, mm-hmm. the composing.
It
and
is.
Of course, it has to be relational because everything else. Mm-hmm.
I know.
Yes.
Which doesn't make it easy.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But, and I'm sure people have written things together, but mm-hmm. I mean, Rose, I am constantly, and I will certainly acknowledge this in the book, but. Rosemary wrote and wrote and wrote while we were at Wellspring. And we have such a history under her pen. I mean, every newsletter. I mean, looking at the newsletters now, looking back on the newsletters of 82, 84, annual reports. And it's amazing, amazing, amazing. I mean, it's not just the chronological stuff, but the political stuff she would put out, and it was quite wonderful. And
I get other people to write, didn't I?
You did, honey. Yeah. But you really were the one that kept you really kept the diary of the place, and it needs to be acknowledged. It was such a gift that we had her and her writing skill, and she has such a way of writing about things. It's wonderful. And I said to her, some of the stuff. I mean, Rosemary wrote songs. Yeah, we are the women who move. I said, we've got to put this stuff in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the solstice, the introduction to the solstice, the solstice poem that she wrote, we got to put that in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody else might
Definitely.
Use it. Don't you agree?
I do.
You've been writing the book all these years,
and that's so right. It's there.
Couldn't have such a radical social justice project without a scribe.
No.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's really what I was reading something today. She didn't even know before we left the house. I picked up and it's something that she wrote back to Wellspring when she was in England, when Wellspring was doing the 2008 strategic plan. And she basically made a case of having to tell the Wellspring story over and over. What she said was, as the author of, was it the something of the bees? Tell me, Secret Life of Bees.
Oh yeah.
She said, you have to tell. She writes, we must tell the story over and over, and unless we do, it will be lost.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosemary referred to that, the most beautiful piece that she wrote back, asking. The people who were doing the strategic plan then to please reflect on the story and on the importance of the house. And, you know, so interestingly, we'll end here. I don't think we mentioned this, but did I mention that the problem of the phrase community of faith how people fought, against that? So that, and did I say that when the mission statement of 2010 was written, it was dropped?
Hmm.
So it simply says that Wellspring, I forget what it says, but really wants everybody to have equal chances or something.
Hmm.
But I don't mean to, a lot of people do this. I think it's really important to define who or what you are. I mean, I just think. There's a lot of consultants who don't agree with me. They say you just get in there, you write a mission statement, and you express the niche that you have in helping people. And I just think that we drew our inspiration and challenge all those years, because it, that mission statement was affirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed. Mm-hmm. And the work that we did, at the end we say, in this spirit of hospitality, we work to meet basic human needs and social justice through, and then we talk, provision of shelter, affordable housing, economic development, local economic development, and education rooted in community needs. And the local economic development, as I say, is really when, you know, we did our bit of that with working capital and stuff, but the big thing was our investment in this community. Paying taxes, we always use local banks. When we did the endowment, we invested that money in the trust department of Cape Ann Savings, and invested it in socially responsible stocks. Mm. That has changed. And that concerns me. I think those are statements. If you're in the business of a community where you want to meet the needs of the community, then you have to invest in the community. I mean, as long as we could shop locally, we did. Mm-hmm. The office center, and we still use the bookstore, and others that are locally. But it's a challenge, and it's also a statement of how big mm-hmm. and impersonal stuff has become. So anyway, mm-hmm. but anyway, you're wonderful. Any other comments?
Thank you so much,
Amy. Oh. From you, any comment, dear?
So you got a lot of help from the government now. There probably isn't any way to get help from the government now these days, right?
Help from the government in terms of programs?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, I think Wellspring is doing a good job. I mean, I think the that's North Shore Community College. That's Stacy that the Department of Education is funding, but. It's not government. I mean, they get money in terms of what do I want to say? People who are at Wellspring still get they get welfare benefits, and there is some money that's coming to help with housing, homeless prevention, that comes through what's called the home-based program, and that's a program that is funded by the state, so hopefully what they do is they pay for a family to have housing, to help them with their housing for a year. And if at the end of that year they have spent all that money down, now there's an initiative to renew it for a second year. Actually, Bruce Tarr has an amendment in the Senate for that, which I called and encouraged him. But there's not much, not direct money. United Way funds Wellspring now, which is good.
I heard of a group, I'm not exactly sure where it was, I think it might have been in Michigan, and they wanted to address the homelessness situation, and so they started a cookie company.
Uh-huh.
And the people work in the cookie company, and they work towards being able to afford their own homes.
That's right.
And so using that relationship
mm-hmm. That's right.
model, mm-hmm. and supporting each other every day gives them some momentum to finally mm-hmm. go on. And
it's wonderful.
Great. So it seems to be working.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Pine Street Inn does the same.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
Pine Street Inn.
Oh, does the same thing.
They're doing the same thing. They have a catering company now. They actually have food trucks that go around.
Oh.
And that's been very helpful. There are some initiatives like that in Boston that are good. Well, aren't
well, thank
you
thank you so much.
Well, you're so welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.